When you drive a vehicle so reliable it's backed by a 10-year, 100,000-mile limited warranty, you stop thinking about what you can't do and start doing what you never thought possible. Visit your local Kia dealer today to see what you're capable of in a vehicle that inspires confidence around every corner. Kia. Movement that inspires.
Call 800-333-4KIA for details. Always drive safely. Limited inventory available. Warranties include 10-year, 100,000-mile powertrain and 5-year, 60,000-mile basic. Warranties are limited. See retailer for details.
The boats were emptied out up at the Spanish Arch, and the women would go over then, and there was buyers coming over from Scotland and every place then, you see, and they were buying up the fish. Now, some of the townspeople would buy the fish as well. But these, I remember, for the herrings mostly, the Scotch people used to come, and they'd have all barrels and everything, and they'd be barreling the herrings, sending them off to Scotland, and the boats would be in the dock.
Screeching gulls, lapping waters, shifting tides, and names like Rope Walk and Dogfish Lane are all nostalgic reminders of the Claddagh, Galway's ancient fishing village on the western bank of the Corrib as it enters Galway Bay. The name Claddagh is derived from the Irish word cladach, meaning seashore. The village was very much a self-governing community with its own ruler or king, who was elected each year on June the 24th, the Feast of St. John. The village has a tradition that places its existence before Galway itself was established, when the Normans came in the 12th and 13th centuries. A village that once had about 500 families and 500 boats fishing the sheltered waters of Galway Bay. Boats of different shapes and sizes, as Father O'Dowd recounts.
There were four types of boats, of sailing boats, all, of course, with their black sails and brown sails. The admiral, if you like, the king of the Claddagh himself, had a white sail. First of all, you had the Galway hooker itself on Bodge Moor, and that could go up to actually 40 feet long. It was a very, very long boat. And then you had, of course, the Lahwaj, which was not actually half the size, but literally three-quarters the size. And then you had my favourite type, which you'll still find in the Claddagh today, the Glochog, which I think comes from the Irish, meaning a beautiful boat. That would be the third one. And then you had the Pookon. Now, the Pookon was possibly the size of the Glochog, but smaller again, and very, very difficult to sail. Now, I'm not an expert on the actual sailing, if you like, the sails of boats and things like that, but it had only one sail, which you manoeuvred around the mast, which is quite difficult, and especially in Galway Bay, in the seas out there, you had to be an expert salesman. But these four type of boats constituted, we'll say, the 300 that used to sail off at the one time. And when they reached the fishing waters, then the king would say, "Fine, right, we start fishing now." And the whole lot would scatter all to their own little areas, and they would lower the nets. Now, the fishing that they carried on was what we call fixed net fishing. In other words, they didn't trawl. And they used nets for herring, but for all other type of fish, they used what was called the long line or the spillet. And, of course, that was really the downfall of the Claddagh, because they did not trawl.
But if changing times and changing circumstances altered the fishing habits of the villagers, the call of the sea was always there, at least on a part-time basis, as Mary Brown remembers.
When my grandfather came first to Galway, he had an attached house down in a laneway. They used to call it Rector's Lane, and he would start weaving there. And then he came on and a bit, and he bought a boat. And when he'd weave during the day, he was a very hard-working man, really. He'd weave during the day, go out fishing at night, come in, and my grandmother would take all the fish over and sell it to the buyers. They threw it up on the quay over in Spanish Arch now, there, just at the Spanish Arch, and they'd sell it there then, you see.
The women folk were very much part of the Claddagh fishing tradition, and Kate Corn was no mean hand at splitting open a herring.
They worked in Ryan's wooden herrings and packing them. You go a day, like to cut them, you go in the next day to pack the barrels. And that time was on a toast in the barrel. And you might have a partner with you. So you'd have to share like 6 shillings maybe for 3 barrels. But it was a lot of hard work now attached to it. But if you were quick enough, you could turn out like 3 or 4 or 5 barrels. You know, it all depended on who your partner was. Some of them now were older women. And then you'd have to salt them as well. You know, pack them with salt. And then 2 days afterwards, you'd have to go in and top them up again. So they used to be packed that way. All along, say, a rose of 4 or a rose of 6, maybe. It all depends on the width of the barrel.
I'd say it was smelly kind of work.
Well, we didn't mind it. The man that employed us, like, he had a tackle shop there, Rowan's. And they had a big shed, like, for doing all the smoke, cutting his fish and doing it. And then they had a man, they had other men then for hooping the barrels. It was a good industry, so it was.
One of the strange things about the whole fishing setup there was that whereas the men went off and fished for often 2 or 3 days and came back exhausted, the minute their boat touched the quayside, it was the women that took over. And it was the women actually who took out the fish, marketed the fish, sold the fish, and controlled the money. Strange, you know, in that sense that it was a matriarchal system which was not common here in the west of Ireland at the time. And we have references to them selling the fish in a line, if you like, in a loop going from the Claddagh up through Raven Terrace, Dominic Street, Breed Street, and down into Cross Street and Decay Street, that type of a situation, which wasn't the best, of course, because selling fish, you had to gut the fish, and you know, it was very messy, and the citizens of Galway complained quite a lot.
The Dominicans and the Church of St. Mary on the Hill always had strong associations with life in the Claddagh. And as we look nostalgically across the water towards the Spanish Arch, in the company of Antaharo Hedoin, other days and other times flood the memory.
Dominicans came here in 1488 and they took over a rundown chapel up on the hill. I presume they repaired it. And since then, they've been very much a part of the Claddagh community. The Claddagh fishermen, they repaired their nets on the floor of the church, which was the only big space available. The Dominicans, I suppose, they share the ups and downs, the sorrows of the local people. I think that comes through very much in the cemetery book of the last century, where the number of people buried or died during the cholera and the famine year.
Their fishing went with the coming of the trawlers. They could not compete against the trawlers. And then About the 1900s, a strange boat appeared on Galway Bay, and they still talk about it. They call it the Gunnamore. And about 1900 up to 1910s, these big, if you like, battleships of the English Navy came up. And never saw the likes of them before, of course, these big dreadnoughts or whatever they were. The sad thing about them was that the sailors on board these came ashore, and the young men of the Claddagh, who had no money in their pockets from the fishing, met these sailors who had money. And all it took was just one of the Claddagh lads to join the English Navy, and they all joined. Unfortunately, so many of them were perished during the First World War. And they were great sailors. Sailing was in their blood, and they were valued. And at one stage then, we have practically the whole generation of the Claddagh men all gone, joined the Navy for the war. The older boats were there. The older people were there. The boats were there. and there was nobody literally to go out with them. So in more recent times, and you hear this reference all the time about the fact that the fishing was going down and the men were on the Gunnamora, and that's literally what happened. The boats were sold then, of course, to the Connemara people. The Claddagh boat was always looked on as the best boat, and that the old boats then sadly were sold to carry turf and carry provisions, we'll say, turf to the Crinuna Mall that what we have at the moment, to Kinvara, and carry provisions to the Aran Islands. And that's how many of the boats actually finished out their lives.
I loved a girl from a Galway town, but our love could never be, for I longed to see the world and the treasures it held for me. So I left my native home, sailed across the raging sea, and to Boston I did go. Worked in a town they called...
The traditions, the customs, and the changes in Claddagh life are often discussed when long-serving citizens like Kate Curran, Eileen Clougherty, and Mary Brown get together for an evening.
Well, if they were going out to fish now and they were passing down, like, and they met this woman and she had red hair, they wouldn't go out. They'd just turn back. Or a white cat. They didn't like to meet a white cat either, but a black cat. They loved to meet a black cat. No, they wouldn't go out. They'd say it was... They wouldn't catch anything for the day. Now, I remember my father telling me one time, he used to take the boat out on a Sunday, cruising around the bay, like, you know, and a crowd of them would go out. And this Sunday he was going to go out. And my grandmother said to him, listen here now, you weren't down at Mass this morning, and you're not going out until you go to Mass. And he didn't go out, but there was four or five of them went out. I think John Folan, there was two brothers anyhow, and Martin Folan went out, and I don't know who was the rest. It's so far back now it's hard to remember. And they went out with the Melodeon, and they were playing out in the bay. And there was a storm came up, and weren't they lost coming back? The boat capsized, they were all lost out on the bay. And she said, if you went, you'd be gone too. She said, no, but I put you down to Mass. And that was it.
And were they drowned?
Well, they were drowned. There was two brothers down. There was only one of them saved that was out on the boat. There was two brothers, and I think there was two more. There was four altogether, as far as I remember now, was drowned that morning. It was a Sunday morning, Sunday evening coming back. And the sky, he said, got awful dark and everything. And the next thing, this big storm came up, and they were drowned on their way. They were taken up over in town.
And another thing they had, if they seen a rat, that was that. But they never, the Claddagh people didn't like a seen rat. They had a word for it, cold iron. And the group would be here to see the rat, it shout to the other, cold iron. They'd all turn back. They wouldn't go out to, they wouldn't go out that time to fish. So then, when they would go out fishing, that's only all fish they ever had then, they ever bothered to fish. And the wives would be home, and they used to make the griddle cakes. And then when the boats would come in, the children would down bring up the fish, and that was the meal then for the evening, and they'd have the griddle cake.
They were very independent people. They had their own industry, fishing industry, and their own homes at the time. Well, building their own homes, when the son now got married out of the house, and they go back to town, which is across the bay near Ordenmore, and they've been over the limestone and the boats to build the house for the son, for the daughter, yeah. But all the land was there, and it was Alcorn's land, supposed to be. He was an English lord, because we used to pay ground and chinchins here. And then we got compensated for the thatched house, so there wasn't much. You know, some of the money was valued, £5. The corporation used to say, you can't take all the stones with you in the walls, we only want the ground. And they got it all for nothing.
In Here beside the Dominican Priory is a building that housed a Piscatorian school, which was established in the last century by Father Raymond Rush during the bad old famine days.
The link also, I think, comes through very much in things like the Piscatory School, which was built by Father Rush in the last century. He saw the need for some training for the fishermen and set up that school. He went off to London and collected £1,200 to start the school. He said that Protestants as well as Catholics supported him, and he organised courses in the art of sailing, navigation, as well as making of nets, making of lines. And then recently I was looking over the programme of the school, I was very much impressed by the wide range of subjects. So in that school, which there was an average at one period of about 400 children on the roll, but I suppose 60% boys, they were prepared to be fishermen out on the bay, but they were also prepared to be sailors on the merchant fleet.
Now, was this school for boys and girls?
Yes, it was for both boys and girls. And the figures I've seen, about a proportion of two to one, two in favour of boys, and the smaller proportion girls. And the girls would learn needlework and embroidery, which may be connected with the grand old tradition in the Tlada of beautiful embroidery, beautiful cloaks, beautiful shawls. May have had something to do with that school in the last century.
Was it a primary or a post-primary school?
No, it was a primary school. And later on, it was officially recognised by the Board of Education, the predecessor of the Department of Education. And it remained an official national school until the 1930s, when the new national school in the Tlada was built higher up on the hill. And it's closed then. But it's interesting that it's now a school again. Last year, an all-Irish school was opened there, Kailash the Curribe. They took in first-year students, and this year they'll take second and third and work their way up to the school. So that's a lovely development, to have an all-Irish school in what was once an Irish-speaking village.
But time marches on, and in the 1930s, the authorities started to demolish the old thatched houses that were such a distinctive feature of Tlada. They were replaced by dwellings which were considered more modern and sanitary.
They were warm in the winter and cool in the summer. A thatched house is always thatch-villa-like, you know. But they used to keep them beautiful. They were whitewashed, inside and outside. Every weekend, everything would be pushed out and scrubbed, everything would be scrubbed. And the hobs, that's the fireplace now, it'd be whitewashed. Be all whitewashed, really. Yeah, they were lovely thatched houses. There's a big row of thatched houses here now where I'm living. And they were knocked down, like, you know. Yeah.
Mm. Well, when did all that end, or what happened, do you remember?
1950, it ended, like, you know. And, no, that was the year I came up. I'd say it'd be about 4 years before that, like. And they fought against it and tried to stop them from knocking them. But they should have kept a few of the thatched houses, definitely.
And what did the bulldozers come along?
Oh, the bulldozers came along. Bulldozed the whole lot of them down. And gave little or nothing for the houses to the people that owned them.
Well, did the corporation build them new houses then?
Oh, the corporation built those houses then, you see. That's how we got up here then, like, you know. And I, as I told you before, now I wanted to slate my own house and put in sanitary arrangements in it. And my husband and myself went up and asked them, could we do it, like, you know, and they said, no, you'll have to get out. It's our ground.
Well, what excuse did they give for demolishing all the thatch cottages?
no sanitary arrangements in them. That was the cause of the whole lot of it, really, like, you know, because there was no sanitary arrangements.
And you mean there were no toilets?
No toilets.
And where did the people
Well, dry.
Go?
They all had dry toilets then. And this corporation van, you go around and you put all your stuff out into that. And that's the way it was. So that's why they were not, really.
Well, I'll tell you about the toilets. 12 o'clock, it's kind of late, and the tide would be full in. They'd wait till the tide would be full in, and they used to go down with buckets and empty, and the tide would go out and bring that all out. Well, how I know that much about it was, there was little Coast Guard houses living near Mrs. Pollington and the mall, and they all used to, like, they one look out and say, they'd go down to see if the tide in. And if it was, well, if it wasn't in till two or three, they'd still go down.
They all went off with their buckets?
Yes, yeah.
And who did that, the women or the men?
Oh, no, the women. Oh, no, the men wouldn't, not at all. The women should do that.
Well, it must have been a great boon then when they got the sewerage and all that.
They did. But then again, as you say, like, if the tide didn't bring it out, that's what I often think of now. Like, long before they cleared away all that sewage, like, they had, that was all going down then, and they wouldn't go out. And it used to be that high with the muck then, like yeah, over yeah. that. Like, it used to be all muck over that, like, you know. And, but still, there'd be no smell like there is now.
And they're thinking now of using Mutton Island for disposing sewage.
Oh, God, they won't. No, they'll take the whole look of Galway Bay away if they put that there. They will. And there's many more. Long before they ever suggested that, it was said to me, I hope to God they won't do anything with that lighthouse.
If I were in Cladder, I'd stand on the pier. 'Tis there I'd see fishermen mending their gear. I'd roam on forever where the white waves roll still. Here's a toast to you, Cladder, at the foot of Fair Hill. They had some fine hurlers, but now they're all gone. May their names live forever, like the great Father Tom. In their green and black jerseys, I remember them still. Here's a toast to you, Cladder, at the foot of Fair Hill. And now to conclude, here's good luck to you all. On land or on sea, or wherever you may roam, may your homes be peaceful by God's holy will. Here's a toast to you, Cladder, at the foot of Fair Hill.
Life was innocent and carefree in those days, and simple pleasures brought their own enjoyment.
You'd meet this fella, like, and you'd be talking to him and everything. But there'd be a crowd of us together. We'd never pair off now, like. And we'd go off out the prom and we'd have a mouth organ. And we'd start dancing on the prom. That's where you learned how to dance. And then I remember the first tech social I went to. Oh, I had an awful job. My grandmother's very strict to get out to it. And I'd say, my other two cousins were going to, then you see, and I said, well, Mona's going and Jean is going and why can't I go? They have brothers and sisters, but you haven't. And you can't go now. But my aunt went over and talked her into letting me to this tech here. Well, it was great, I thought. And do you know, we talk about it now, but the Angelus was ringing and we're coming out of that dance. But there was no such thing as drinking it.
You mean the Angelus the following morning?
The following morning.
And what are we doing all night?
Dancing, and we had a big dinner, like, you know, and talk, and that's all we were doing. We'd be all together there, and we'd have sets and the dickens knows what, like, you know, never outside, and there was no drink, and we'd have tea then, and coming home then we'd go out to 7 o'clock mass in the Jazz Church, all out to 7 o'clock mass, then we'd be all together.
Must there be any courting going on at all?
Well, you'd get an odd kiss now and again, like, you know, you'd have to do that, wouldn't you? So that should be it then, like, you know. But that's all. No, the times have changed terrible bad now. I don't like the tangs now, really, that's in it. No, what you hear, like, you know.
There was big families in Clare. My grandson, my mother-in-law had 21 children. Some of them lived, some of them died. But she had a loft divided. The boys upstairs, and then there's small little rooms, and that there was the girls. They laugh at me now, but I couldn't tell you what kind of condom is. I never seen one. I never knew anything about them, and then like that. No, never. And we never had any kind of that. Do you know, we used to go out to prom, for our fun, we used to go out to prom after the confraternity, in the, we'd have a confraternity down the chapel. And we'd all go out, girls and boys, out on the prom. And Paddy Griffin would have the Melodeon, and we would dance there till 11 o'clock.
Also at wakes, we find that wakes was not a time of real sorrow in the sense that somebody died. Wakes were a time of enjoyment in the sense that it was a coming together of all the people, first of all, of course, to sympathise, but also to partake. Now, the partaking meant that there you would get some sustenance for the adults, which would be of the liquid type. The youngsters even loved to go there because they would get jam. This comes across a lot, that they would get jam. And, of course, there was the doujin to be smoked, and there was snuff. And it was a type of, if you like, a situation where people were mourning fine, but also they were, if you like, celebrating the fact that that person was going from one world to another. And rather strange customs took place as well, where you had games being played around in the room where the corpse was. You had chairs, for instance, put in a semicircle, and the people would sit down on the chairs, and there would be literally a ringmaster who would go out and he'd cut a stick, and he would stand in front, and he would start off a game called The House that Jack Built. And he would, you know, it was played in other parts of the country as well, but this is a very serious here, where he would stand in front of you and he'd say, "You say it after me, this is the house that Jack built," and he would go to each person, and then he would add on and add on. And I have, thanks to Michael Griffin of the Cladder, he has given me the whole, if you like, whole story of that, you know, all the spiel, if you like, and how they had to do it. And if you didn't, if you missed, then you got a slap. And if you got three slaps, eventually you were out. And this was going, this would go on for hours and hours. They had, of course, the spin the bottle as well, and we all know what that means. So it was a time of...
and the poor corpse was lying there in the bed.
Lying there. And in the initial stages as well, what I mean by the initial stages, when we first have written records of this, some of the wakes went down for 2 or 3 days. And it was a time of, you know, enjoyment in the sense of people would come you know, sympathise. And of course, then you had the serious side. You had the Queen in that went on.
Molly, do you remember then at some wakes they would have the band Queen Shower, the cleaning woman?
Yeah, the why did you die? Goodbye now, Johnny, what'll I do tonight? Ah, you were always good to me, Johnny. Goodbye now, Mark, and they'll be hitting the bed, got help, you know. But that was the way they did it. And then they'd pray a lot. They were sincere, all right, you know, but then they get a bit, they had a few drops taken, you know, their spirits are raised.
Well, the Cladder Ring it's called a fader ring. It really didn't start in the Cladder as such. We have evidence, for instance, of it being in Roman times. There are Spanish connections, there are various connections, but it really came into being in the Cladder in the last century especially. There are two origins, of course. One, a fable that a certain strange eagle flew over a bridge one time that was being built and dropped the ring down to a lady of the Joyce clan. She was a very rich lady, and she spent her money building bridges, and this seemed to be a divine intervention, if you like, to pay her, and this ring was the Cladder design. The other, of course, more plausible story, obviously, would be the one of Richard Joyce, who was a Claddagh man, who was captured by the Moors. It seemingly the Moorish pirates used to operate quite a lot along the coastlines of Ireland in the 16th and 17th centuries. And this young man was captured and made a slave, I think, in Algeria, according to tradition. And there he learned, he became a goldsmith, if you like, a slave, but acted as a goldsmith. And he became so good at his work that he became famous. And then I think it was Charles III, when he came into power, impelled on these Arab people, tribal people, or whatever they were at the time, to let go all the any of the British subjects that were there. And he was let go, and he wanted to come back home. And the story tells that his master wanted to give him half his fortune and his daughter in marriage if he would stay, but no. But he came back, and seemingly he was one of the first goldsmiths. Well, he wasn't one of the first, but one of the more famous ones. And to this man then, of course, is attributed the Claddagh ring, that he brought back the idea of the of, you know, the Claddagh ring itself, the design of it, and that it took off from there.
Well, there's a crown as a crest to remind us of honour, and clasp in a heart that God blessings will bring. A circle of gold always keeps home contented, with true love entwined in my old Claddagh ring. That's the story now of the Claddagh ring. And that's my great-grandmother's Claddagh ring that I have on my finger.
And as they come into the line, it's Patricia, number one, Patricia. Sabina is number five. Number six is Jess. Number 10 is Sephoria. And number two is Flyboy. And these are the first five riders. Number 12 is Champ. And number three is Riverside Lad. And the last man to cross the line is number nine. Number nine, Beachy Boy. And there you have it, ladies and gentlemen. The fifth race on the card, the Claddagh Hooker Stakes.
It's a place now which I think of all places in Galway City has an identity which they're very, very proud of. They have a tradition going way back, and that proudness is that pride is evident now, for instance, in that they used to hold what was called the Claddagh Festival years ago, and you'd have donkey races and cart horse races and so forth back in the swamp to collect money for a community hall. And they have, you know, that strange pride which goes back, you know, and it's, of course, is reflected in the Dominican community that's there, that has stood with them all down all through the years. That soccer, I presume, through the fact that so many of the young men had gone to England and in the English Navy and even in the Army, that is, you know, they had come across soccer and they seemed to like that. And from then on, you find this evolving of soccer in the Claddagh, starting off with various teams. The Claddonians now were a great team there, and they won. They had a famous victory in the town league, I think it was. It was the Schweppes Cup of 1936-37. And there were other matches as well, five-a-sides and things like that. And the whole thing was that hurling, the Gaelic aspect then died out, and the Claddonians then evolved into Rovers, which eventually became Galway Rovers, of course, and eventually became Galway United. But Galway Rovers are still there. They have underage teams and they play in the swamp. So you find that that whole area of sporting activity changed from a Gaelic to, if you like, let's not say alien, but into a different type of code, if you like, from now on, from that period onwards.
The Claddagh, once an Irish-speaking village, is now almost silent in the native tongue, and the cúpla focal that echo across Fair Hill and Gorry Glas are few and far between. But Mary Brown recalls the time she attended Irish classes at the Tech in Domnick Street, and her teacher was none other than Pádraic O'Conaire, whose stories and writings grace the pages of many an Irish language school text.
He was very nice, really, now, like, you know, but he was a bit soft, which is, some nights we wouldn't go in and he wouldn't mind. night time, and sometimes in the day we wouldn't turn up. We might, if it was a fine day, now we'd go to the beach and wouldn't go in. But he wouldn't question you, or he wouldn't send a report home about you. But he was very nice now, I'll have to say, the Lord rest his soul. He was a very nice man.
And what else do you remember about him? Did you know that he was a writer and was going to become famous?
Yes, that he was going to be a writer and he was going to become famous. And when he died, I attended the funeral up at the new cemetery.
That was in 1928?
Yes. He was a famous man, really, like, you know.
When you were in the classes with Páraic O'Conaire, he had the name of moving out a lot.
Well, yes. He'd give us our lessons on the board and he'd say, well, do them now, girls and boys. It was mixed class. Girls and boys, do them now, and I'm going out. And he'd go across the road to Seamus O'Leary's for his few pints.
In Dominic Street?
In Dominic Street. It's Porter's now, isn't it, you say? And he'd go across the road to Seamus O'Leary's and he'd be there until 10 o'clock then, until the bell would ring. And then he'd come over and he'd say, come on, boys and girls, out now. Have you that lessons done? He never looked at them. He never looked at the lessons. But I was very fond of him, really.
Well, at that time, did you realise that he was gone over for a few pints?
Well, we knew he was over in Seamus O'Leary's. Someone had said, oh, someone now might fire a big paper or something, or hit someone, like, you know, the way they go on in class. Like, oh, we'll go across to Seamus O'Leary's for him now and bring him over because he's over there. That's where he used to be, over in Seamus O'Leary's, having his big pint.
On a Sunday in mid-August, crowds still come to the Cladda for the traditional blessing of Galway Bay as the herring season opens. Only a few boats now remain of the once famous Galway fleet, but they are joined by the trawlers that replace them.
Part of the ceremony of the blessing of the bay in August, mid-August, is the boats go out from the Cladda Pier, and then around Mutton Island, one of the little otter boys rings a bell, a handbell at this time, and that's the signal for the boats around to gather for the actual blessing of the waters and the blessing of the fishermen. So bells are very much part of the history of the Cladda Church.
And when day is done, the residents often come together to sing, to gossip, and to exchange stories.
One night we were in the club and there was a big crowd, like, and this woman, she was a grand woman, and she came in and she was a lovely singer. We used to always get her to sing and all, and Molly's singing all, and she always used to sing Golden Earrings and all this. So we're all sitting around the table and we're talking, and next she was saying, oh, in the middle, she said about her husband wasn't well at all, and she said it's awful, and she started crying. And she said, I wouldn't mind. She said, well, he's so good and everything. Oh, please God, we were saying he'd be all right. So anyway, the following Monday night, she came down and she said, I had to get the doctor for poor Mickey. She said, not well at all, she said. And she said, he had to go into hospital, she had. But anyway, she came in this night and she said, they had to get the doctor. And she said, he has to go in now, she said, to have an X-ray, she said. And he has what's this? Was something wrong, like, but she's good. I don't know what now it was, but she gave it a queer name, like, you know. And we didn't say anything, like, the president was there, and she put her head up that way, and she was laughing. This woman now wasn't educated enough to pronounce the big word, you see, but she called it something. And what's this? What she called it? And we all start laughing, like, but we didn't let her see us laughing. So we went on then for a good while, and we're coming home, and it says, Molly, what was that she preached? We said, what's wrong with her husband? And the president said, Eileen, you tell her. Oh, no, when I looked, she was walking away, and Molly was saying, what is it, she said, and she said, it strangled balls, says she. What kind of things is them, says Molly? when I looked, one woman was across the road and I was left in the middle of the street and here was Manny. What kind of things to them? Oh, God, God, I never heard the like of them before.
The office of King or Admiral of the Fleet disappeared with the demise of the fleet itself. However, the custom was revived in the early 70s, and the last King of Clada was Paddy Corran, known locally as Ladnin. Sadly, he passed away some weeks ago, and with him went a man of great kindness and understanding. The King is gone, but his voice lingers on.
I love everyone in Clada. And everyone looks at it, I think, loves me. And I love to see everyone getting on, even though I have nothing myself. For some people, it begrudges one another, but I don't believe in that. That's my way of going out.
Well, could I take that now, Paddy, as a royal message from a king to his subjects?
Oh, yeah, tell them all what I said. I adore everyone in the village.
Well, Paddy, thanks very much for talking to us, and I better let you get back now to your royal duties. That is, if you have any to perform today.
I have a few horses now, that's all. I'll be in York for the afternoon, down in some pub, looking at the races. That's where I spend my time.
Well, after all, horse racing is the sport of kings.
Sure, yeah, that's why I'm so fond of them.